Alright, time for another DoNotGod.com video presentation. So, today, one of my 20,000 videos or whatever, I'm going to respond to a Clark Ellison video. So he's only made 12 videos. The average view is 1 million for 12 videos. 12. And they all have, millions of views. Very bizarre. I mean, I don't know exactly how you do that in 12 videos, get that many views. But anyway, 321,000 subscribers. So, a couple of titles that were interesting, right? So, The Desire to Never Have Been Born. That was a more recent video. And he already did a video called The Desire to Not Exist. And that had 6 million views. So I figure we'll play maybe both of them eventually, but I'll play one of these anyway. And just respond to the conversation. So it's good that it's gotten some exposure, the subject, but it's kind of weird how, I don't get it entirely. I don't see the great insight. Yes, there's pictures, okay, but yeah, this isn't exactly a anything you say on the subject is almost going to be profound. When you're talking about the meaning of life, it's automatically interesting to me anyway, what somebody might have to say. I don't get it. But anyway, so I'll go find the video. Matt appeared to have found it, so leave us begin. We'll see how it goes.
It's likely that millions, perhaps even billions of people, have at one point or another felt the desire to not exist.
So he's going to qualify that desire to be the desire not to exist, that is, the desire not to be or anything. And we all do that. I mean, you go to sleep and you don't dream, you don't exist, so I don't even really understand it, frankly, this wordplay. So, false assumption to start with, a false premise, I guess, that people have some desire to just not exist, as opposed to, in some way other than they don't want to do this, and they want to do something else, which seems obvious.
When I say not exist, I'm not talking about the way some people wish they had never been born, or even somebody's self-destructive fantasies.
So, what are you talking about? You're either trying to escape what is, okay, and be where there's nothing, where you're just left alone. I can't understand any other way to experience not existing, because if you're experiencing not existing, you're not experiencing.
No, the desire to not exist is a yearning to magically disappear, preferably in a way that doesn't require any sadness, violence, or death.
All right, well, I think all the people who want to be dead, or rather be dead, or wish they never existed, I'm sure they would wish not to do it violently or terribly. So that's, you think there's actually a real percentage of suicidal people who just want to do something destructive to themselves? You really think that's a thing? No, it's not a thing.
You may know it as the wish to fall asleep and never wake up again.
That's that's not nothing, first. And it's a graceful exit. So why wouldn't anybody who's a little bit fatigued with existence find it horrifying? They wouldn't find it scary, that's for sure. Doesn't have any skeletons in it, necessarily.
As often as this desire is felt, it's mysteriously rarely discussed. What I found surrounding why we sometimes...
for most people who are, let us say, suicidal, it's something they have to live with for very protracted periods of time. And seldom does one completely change.
feel this way says a lot about the nature of our existence, desires, and how we interpret the existence of others.
Yes, our understanding of what it is to be a living organism on planet Earth, that context. And this is where all the all the bullshit starts.
And one of the most memorable scenes from Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov.
So, yeah, I guess this is just, let's pretend we're very literate. Anyway, so he says it's the most memorable scene. And I would argue it's just rhetoric, not all that memorable. Not really all that. I think a little less volume here, maybe.
A monk and an atheist walk into a bar. They're brothers, Karamazov, to be exact. What ensues is a debate about the existence of God, albeit an unconventional one. In our world...
So again, this is, pretending this is, it's profound and interesting. It's not very profound or interesting. A discussion about the existence of God is just sort of, something you should get over with when you're about 17. You should be done having discussions about that, in any other context than to argue with other assholes, and persuade them not to be an asshole. I mean, it's just such a, it's like debating Santa Claus. I mean, it has no more credibility than debating Santa Claus.
Nobody escapes the torture of daily pains and disappointment. Even children suffer in horrific extremes.
Yes, all kinds of horror in the world. Why would a god invent all of that? And why would little kids get cancer? Why would bad things happen to good people if there was a god? And blah, 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 blah. And the answer is because, obviously there's not a god. I mean, obviously. It's nature. It's a DNA molecule.
Thus, God, the elder of the two brothers maintains, must be evil to have introduced us to such a world. Any promises of paradise after this life are just taunts. Life is but a cruel angel's thesis.
So, and the cruel angel would be evolution. But it has no brain, it's just a process. So it's kind of silly to consider it a functioning device that decides to do something. It's a process. And it's the process that makes organisms complicated. And the price is that they are going to be complicated, but they're built by an idiot. So they're not going to be complicated in any good ways. They're going to be complicated in stupid, wasteful ways. Fact. Crocodile, Anyway, commercial. I have to get rid of that. Continuing.
Odd. I just most respectfully return him the ticket, he says.
Right. Just, ask for your money back. your time. It's a simple argument. If somebody gives you a gift, it's a piece of shit. You say, I'd rather you just gave me the money.
Ivan Karamazov rejects all notions of God's goodness. But even further than that, we can interpret that for Ivan, it is not so important to contemplate whether or not God exists. The question that must be asked is whether or not we want to exist in a world like this one.
No, it's not the question to ask. The question to simply ask is, is this a profitable infestation on Earth? And somehow is, the grotesque amount of attrition, that is all of the death, is it worth it? To watch, if we were back a few hundred years ago, you could have 10 brothers and sisters, and by the time you're 50, half of them are dead, or more than half, and in all kinds of insidiously horrible ways. And so how could anybody love anybody or care about anything if they're going to watch all of that happen to them and accept it and say, thank you. thank you. This is so much fun. I love this kind of roller coaster. Where you get attached to something and then you watch it horribly get killed. In some kind of brutal way, plague and stuff like that. I just can't wait. it's laughable, that any of this shit is worth it. That whatever we're doing in terms of pursuing these little, desires to gain some sort of prestige or success or status or position or capacity to think, you know, we're better than them. And that, well, I had that thought and gee, it just made my day. It's just so trivial. Yeah, that's worth, you know, essentially, you know, tormenting and killing children. Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, it's, you know, it's only a game a psycho killer could see a point in playing.
This idea would be repeated by Albert Camus, who famously made the remark that in deciding whether or not one should kill oneself, one answers the fundamental question of philosophy. When we think of...
Oh, brother. So anyway, so it's very complicated, this killing yourself thing, because, yeah, obviously if you can know that there's no capacity to change anything or fix anything, I mean, you're never going to be able to cork a vagina or you're never going to be able to do anything to prevent somebody else's harm, well, then, yeah, kill yourself. You know, but frankly, there's lots of work to do here in terms of if you're going to care about your own suffering, you have to care about the suffering of everything, because it's just a fact that it's no different. Yours is not special. So that's not a very hard thing to figure out. And once you know yours isn't special, well, then you know, I have obligations. I have to make some effort here, you know. Can't win the war if nobody shows up to fight the war. I mean, duh.
The desire to not exist. We usually imagine something akin to this kind of thinking. The idea that life is meaningless and insufferable is a popular one.
you know, in spite of the fact that we're not going to say anything real as a society or a culture to recognize that popularity, acknowledge its existence, and at least make some tepid statement to the reckless reproducers that, you know, what you're doing is just causing a bunch of harm. You're really cruel and evil, ignorant pieces of dirt.
However, when compared to these outlooks, the desire to not exist is unique.
I don't know what that even means. The desire to not exist is unique versus what? You know, I guess it's unique in the sense that the desire to evade pain and suffering is what they're doing. So again, this paraphrase that people want to not exist for no reason. You know, just something they do for the fun of it is to imagine our desire not existing. You know, you desire to be comforted, to be comfortable. And so you only need to desire not to exist if your existence is less than satisfactory.
These individuals' desire is not death, but to experience non-experience.
So again, they're not trying to experience something that can't be experienced. So you're just saying that somehow they're oxymoronic and they think they can, you know, they can have a velocity in no direction? No, they can't do that. They can't be going 50 miles an hour in no direction. You think they're that stupid? As dumb as a physicist, maybe?
The desire is not a logical set of beliefs about the characteristics of life, but a complex psychological wish. Further,
so I don't know. So this is gobbledygook written mush that you, what the hell are you talking about? You know, people just running away from, you know, pointless and wasted suffering.
Furthermore, not everyone who longs for nothingness thinks existence is entirely unbearable.
That's just, Show me the person who longs for nothingness but isn't in pain. Okay, show me that person, because I don't think they exist. I think that's a false premise you just invented out of thin poop.
To not want to die, but also wanting to simply not exist, implies a contradictory hope that one might continue to go on living.
I don't even know what this conversation is. They want to be non-existent and yet live. No, they don't. I mean, it's just, you know, why are you, so I don't know, How could somebody, you know, 6 million views for that kind of gibberish?
Most tempting way to explain this is to bring up what is called cognitive dissonance. When a person has two contradictory beliefs, but can only embody one of them, they will pick the one that is easier to exhibit. In this case, it's easy to suggest that the people who...
So again, more nonsense about people choose the harder choice all the time. Going to war, you know. Oh, gee, I have some dissonance about going to war and getting killed. Yes, but then they have some counter dissidents where, well, I don't want to go to prison, and or else, you know, yeah, it's just, you know, Dad, what would Dad say? You know, be a good soldier, boy, or some other kind of bullshit to get over their dissidents.
Would like to not exist, continue to live their lives because death is much too messy and final. It takes a certain dedication to accept death.
So death and dying are two different things. So the physical process of having to endure being squished out of existence is one issue of potential fear and foreboding. And then there's the concept of just your story being, you know, unfinished and the book being closed. And I'd argue that they're... You know, one is a very rational and one is kind of mushy in terms of it just built out of ego and, you know, a letting go of a hunger and saying, I'm not going to satisfy it. You know, there's a box of snacks and I'm not going to eat the snacks.
Of course, there is something to be said for this idea. After all, most people would hesitate to see death as a solution to their problems, but this outlook of cognitive dissonance ignores the intense feeling these individuals still experience, not to mention the ways they'll still attempt to replicate nothingness in their own lives.
So they'll replicate nothingness? I mean, this is just, I don't even know how anybody found this to be at all interesting. What the fuck are you talking about? What does it have to do with this virtual reality crap? I don't, sorry. I mean, this is mush.
One way of reading this contradiction is that it is prohibition that leads to fantasy. We desire that which we can.
So you just put a bunch of little clippy art pictures together, you know, for us, a babbly script, and you can get 6 million views. It's just amazing. I find it amazing. I mean, this is mush. He hasn't said anything. People have feelings about being alive or dead, and they're just kind of feeling feelings about it, and they're feeling feelings, and they have these thoughts and feelings about being alive or dead, and they have thoughts and feelings. Yeah, right.
Cannot have. Not only is not...
Maybe I'll make that video. Just with pictures. I bet you have some feelings about feelings, and then you have some feelings about your thoughts, about your thinking, about your feelings, and then you're sometimes feeling about your thoughts, and once in a while you feel something and say, oh, that if I had those thoughts, and I have my feeling about my thoughts, and then I have a thought about my feelings about my thoughts. Yeah, you do.
Nothing is impossible. We're told that we must not achieve it. We might therefore desire nothingness simply as a way to exert our freedom.
Yeah, it's a power move. whatever. Just such a wacky premise. I desire to be nothing, you know, and experience it. Yeah. Oh, God. Can't do that.
The impossible is desired all the more for its impossibility. One of the best references to the desire to not exist can be found in the philosopher...
So, the desire to not exist, which is sensible, versus the desire to be non-existent and experience it, which is nonsense. Okay.
Soren Kierkegaard's book, The Sickness Unto Death. Kierkegaard's argument is that the torment of the desire to not exist is the hopelessness of not even being able to die.
It just makes the whole subject even messier, right? It's bad enough that we're in bad circumstances. It's, you know, we have this addictive complex of competition, desire, you know, this need to feel as though we have done the right thing and are complete and have, you know, we can play a victory song. We have this psychological need to feel like a winner, driving us. And yet, you know, we can know logically that's all bullshit. You know, ain't gonna matter. It's not gonna fix anything. It's a delusion. And then you have this real fact that it's getting out isn't as easy as just, you know, you don't just turn a little knob and, whoa, there, I'm gone. There. And it should be that easy.
Death means an end to life, a perceived nothingness. Though not a sickness that will literally end in death. Once a more horrifying reality than death is encountered, one will wish they could die. When even this last respite is taken from them, the desire to disappear will consume them in an act that Kierkegaard calls despair. But as we've already discussed, those that suffer from the desire to not exist don't...
Yes, it's bad to be in pain. It's even worse to know it's going to keep happening, and that you, to get out of it, you have to endure more of it. That just sucks. I mean, when you're in pain, you don't want more pain. Especially when you're in pain.
Don't exactly want to die. Kierkegaard, a deeply religious thinker, thought of despair as a response to the eternity that lies after death. By replacing his...
So, if you say, look, as soon as you do this religious thinker stuff, it's not thinking. It's daydreaming. It's baby talk. It's ridiculous. You know, so a Santa Clausetalist, you know, just say that, you know. So he's done. You can't have any credibility in having a conversation about reality if you're a religious kook. It's just not possible.
Mentions of death with the idea of nothingness, we lose something from his writings. But even if we disassemble this part of his argument, the most fascinating portion still remains. There exist, even in life, simulated perceptions of eternity. When time is slowed to a crawl...
So whatever. So the only eternity is the recognition that it's 300 million, 300,000 million years. Yeah. Of you know, all of this very unpleasant, negative... it's that would be like, what, 300 billion years? No, that's not what I meant. 300,000 years. No, that's not, still not right. Yeah, it's 300. All right, I'll just give up. It's getting old. This is really a thing, this getting old thing. All right, 300 million. Yeah, years of birth, struggle, death. You know, and it's all, the struggle can be, you know, you can survive dying more than once, so the struggle can be really struggly, and you know, the death can be really, really bad. You know, literally, you can have parts cut off, all kinds of experiences. You know, watching your kids die, watching your wife or husband die, all kinds of just grislyly bad stuff. And we just have done this, you know. So the volume of it, and for what? So we can have this ego problem saying somehow I'm special and you need to preserve me in a jar. Something like that. And if we can't do that, then just make more people and maybe one of them will be me again. Something like me. I don't even know if that's what people are thinking. I don't know. Obviously, they're not weeping because the Martians are missing. So that's important to recognize, okay? They're not crying any tears for the poor Martians that aren't here. So it's really just about their ego and nothing else. Something like that. And button.
All in every monotonous day bleeds out in unity, we are held a hostage of eternity. Boredom, depression, and nostalgia all linger here. but some of the less familiar...
I like that snake thing. That was sort of interesting, so I probably should go find that again. That was a good image. So I wonder who did that one. That's pretty good. An eternity of, you know, birth and death, and pretty much shit in between.
Hostage of eternity. Boredom, depression, and nostalgia all linger here. But some of the less familiar residents of non-time also deserve a mention. The delirious ache of desire is felt.
Non-time. I mean, who wrote this mush? Ugh.
Here, and it is also in the silence of eternity that we catch our glimpse of nothingness. Eternity is important to Kierkegaard's argument because it preserves everything he says a despairing person wishes they could be freed from. It's in eternity that the self remains immutable.
It's just a, you know, logical thing. So to me, that's the important logical thing, is to understand that being dead, you being dead, is not going to solve the problem. Because that's not how you, well, it's exactly how you got here, so to speak. You poofed into existence, frankly. And so until you break the poofter, you're stuck coming back in some version of yourself.
It's exactly what can be so dreadful about it. A self is a heavy burden. During the total ceasefire of time, the inability to...
The total ceasefire of time. What is this? You know, what the fuck could that possibly mean? The total ceasefire of time. What the fuck does that mean?
Escape from ourselves grows ever more prominent. Under the right conditions, that can be its own...
So, escape from ourselves, that's not the game. I mean, clearly the game is really messy, okay? I mean, it's child slaughter, and everything else gets slaughtered also, but it's just more brutal to the first losers, the more obvious losers. It's like you win the race, they're still going to kill you. All right, they're just not going to kill you right on the track. They're going to kill you in the back room. You're still doomed, and that's the real it gets even worse part, is they're actually going to kill the winners. The lucky will be unlucky eventually.
Form of suffering.
I mean, you know, the house always wins kind of thing. The dark side will win. It'll take all your money in the end.
At a first glance, the anime Neon Genesis Evangelion appears to be about angsty teens piloting giant robots as they fight otherworldly entities referred to as
angsty. Oh, well, why don't you show us Pokemon or something and have us try to figure what the fuck that's about? Whatever. What the fuck this is about.
Eat up! We don't want the pork!
What the fuck that's about. Commercials. Ew, mouse isn't working. Alright, I think I'm somewhere where I was supposed to be. But in reality...
The show is about one 14-year-old boy's fight with his desire to not exist. Of course, spoilers ahead. Each of the main characters suffers from an intense existential loneliness. However, it's in Shinji, a character modeled after the anime's creator, that we find the show's depiction of this desire. Episode 16 is even titled The Sickness Unto Death, in reference to Kierkegaard. Eva isn't shy about naming its philosophical influences. By explicitly using philosophy, Neon Genesis Evangelion presents us with an interesting existential argument. In order to understand that argument, we need to take a look at the ideas of the philosopher...
So again, the ideas of, in these gigantic books, there's like two sentences that are relevant, and the rest of it is just a bunch of, you know, this. Yeah, jargon and bullshit. And it doesn't really get to the simple point that we're bugs. That's all. Evolution just evolves the bug diagram, and that's all we are. So we're bugs that can sing and dance, and we can talk about numbers and kind of bullshit. But it's just bugs.
Arthur Schopenhauer, another one of the anime's major influences. In his book, The World as Will and Representation, Schopenhauer describes the way individuality can cause...
So he could have shown the book is, you know, 2 inches thick to say life sucks. Yeah, you know, and it doesn't really say that. It just says a lot of other things like women be bitches.
suffering. He argues that the world is made up of will and representation. While the total universe is in fact one thing operating in unity, human beings...
In unity, whatever that is, it's unified universe. Yes, the united unity of the unified unity, unitizers, united. Yeah, you. It's the you verse, whatever.
Each have their own will, distinct from that of the universe and each other.
So the whole will thing is just a delusion, okay? Your brain is just a reflexive organism. You've been programmed, dented by your life, and those dents are like Braille, okay? And they will interpret what comes in and add to it or subtract to it in different ways and cause a reflexive response from your subconscious, organized blueprint of symbols and representations. And that's all there is. There's no none of this wooey crap.
Furthermore, each person only experiences a limited sample of the total universe, causing...
And who cares? Yes, right. So again, we have to sample all the dirt on Earth before we can know what dirt is. Oh. Too ridiculous, too silly, wasted time, mush.
Them to have their own unique perspectives, longings, and pains.
Obviously, and unique by what standard? Again, how unique, how actually different is any of it? Are you one in a million, or one in 15, or one, what's the real number, realistically, in terms of how you'd answer a simple question?
To Schopenhauer, as long as human beings exist separately from one another, there will be suffering.
This is more mush. There will be suffering because we're built to sense anything and everything. And nature doesn't care that it wastes it. That is, it doesn't care that you already know you have a broken leg and there's no point in you feeling the pain anymore. Or some kind of crap like that. There are probably better examples. But yeah, that's the way we're built. And the fact is, we're not built to be survivors. We're built to lay eggs and drop dead.
This dilemma is portrayed countless times in Evangelion, as the main cast of characters repeatedly struggle to deal with the pain inherent to the process of becoming close to another person. Eva doesn't just stop.
Yeah, and these are like, really, this is, they haven't even touched upon the real, life gets a lot tougher, as they start to... getting old and deteriorating and having to accept a duller and less interesting life. That really sucks. When your prospects are, really running out, your chance of catching the big fish is, getting thinner and you're all out of bait, And, then fishing isn't quite as much fun.
Here, though. The shadowy organization Zila, German for soul.
I don't know why we all have to know all this about some anime, I don't know. Do we really, we all have to see it?
Seeks the literal unification of all human life through...
Oh, brother, so whatever that is. Jesus. How can anybody make any sense out of kind of crap like that? What do you want to do? You want to mind meld with a crocodile? It's not going to be that interesting. Hungry chomp chomp. This is not gonna,
It's called the Human Instrumentality Project. The project is intended to destroy the boundaries of our egos and allow for total harmony.
All right, now it would be interesting, yes, if they had some story about how, some scientist figures out that, the whole universe does seem to have a transformer. we just need to pull the plug.
As each person's consciousness is merged into one total unit.
Oh, whatever this is. I don't even know. But this is all bloody looking. I don't know what the hell. There's a bunch of little Damocles swords flying down. What does this graphic have to do with the anime, I wonder? Doesn't look like that merging of consciousness is a good thing.
Don't leave me. Don't ignore me.
Don't kill me!
What the hell is this?
Freddy's Nightmare? I don't know. You play this anime as a torture. Oh, God.
This apocalyptic event will unite...
Oh, dear. Now we have all the little religious symbolism.
All minds, hearts, and bodies as one. In the movie End of Evangelion, after the Human Instrumentality Project is unwittingly...
So I can't believe this got 6 million views. This mush. Talking about some fucking anime. With a bunch of spiritual numerology thrown in.
Put into motion by Shinji, we're presented with a surreal commentary on the psychology of those who desire nothingness.
Asuka, help me! Please! Asuka, you're the only one for me!
Desire nothingness. I mean, it really just doesn't... it just isn't a thing. Is there somebody who really desires nothingness? They don't desire to get away from pain. No, they desire nothingness.
You're lying. You know you are. You'd run up to anyone. You're afraid of Misato and Rei. You're afraid of your father and your mother. It's just that now you're only running to me. It's the easiest and least painful thing to do.
Come on, Asuka, help me.
The truth is you've never really loved anybody.
Yeah, the truth is love is really superficial. And, you know, damn, it just sucks, you know. Because the fact is, people fall in love, and then 3 months later, they're in love with somebody else. Yeah. It's all really ugly.
The psychoanalyst and philosopher Jacques Lacan suggested that our desires form in response to our separation from one another.
Oh, whatever. I mean, I just can't even hug stuff. Oh, we all need a group hug. Then everything will be fine. I'm sure everything will be just fine. Fuck.
Lacan often discussed the existence of something called the other. We can understand his mentions of the other in two ways. First, as someone who is not you. Second...
All right, so I guess I understand why it's 6 million views. Everybody is a fucking lunatic. And yes, of course, 20 years of doing this stuff, trying to have a serious conversation about human understanding and human psychology, and of course have gotten nowhere because people are all crazy. Oh, shit. I didn't know you were all crazy. I really thought there were some people that were sort of like me and they just tried to do this logical thing and try to figure out where they are and how they are and what they're supposed to do in some sort of reasoning, apply, sensible propositions to our reality. But no, it's all this bullshit.
And as the Big Other, a more enigmatic character. The Big Other's essential feature is that we struggle to know what it desires despite our persistent efforts to find out. The Big Other is not a person, per se. It is a symbol.
Per se. Anyway, so the Big Other is a symbol of what? What's the big takeaway here?
A category. All desire forms in response to some lack in our lives. All desire fundamentally presupposes other desires.
A lack of reasonableness. We're not built to be reasonable in the sense that this very point that, we're, biologically built to succeed in, by evolution, the old tie. So it doesn't happen this way anymore, but I mean, that's what it used to be, is that the whole idea was to out-survive the other assholes and make more babies. Get your DNA into the future, and by hook and crook, and that's all it was. And so, it was to do this whole pursue the alpha path, and so we all still have that sense of that competitive sense, and that's why sports is so popular and all this crap, is because we all have a visceral sense, a need to succeed, to defeat.
And all desire craves recognition. Lacan's argument is that your desire comes from your best guess as to what the Big Other lacks or desires. The Big...
Oh, brother, this is worse. I mean, this is just such psychobabble. The Big Other.
The Other is always present in the mind. It's imagined presence leading you to wonder if your desire is acceptable, and more importantly, if you, as you define yourself, are a desirable person. Schopenhauer saw the individual will of the self as a pointless striving with no end.
So there's a truth to this giving up thing in the sense that some people, when they do this introspection thing, they find out they really are pieces of shit. And then they figure that they can't fix it. And so they might as well go full shit. You know, they might as well just stop thinking. You know, because they're never going to be able to fix that Dorian Gray portrait in the closet. The Dorian Gray would be a much better story to build this all out of, is this self image and the fact that once in a while you get a glimpse of your real self, you know, and yeah, ooh, scary.
Him, only suffering arises from our wants, because our wants can only stem from an initial dissatisfaction. This also applies to what Lacan is saying here about desire. There are many ways one's desire might repel others, and it is always a fact that we never truly comprehend what the other desires from us.
Ugh, brother. It's all this mush. So there really isn't that much to it. It's just this sense of possession and attachment, ownership. And that's what so many relationships are made out of and all that kind of crap. And it's all, you know, quite... It's stupid psychology.
The burden of desire easily finds itself implicated alongside pain. Evangelion makes a very important point that obsessing over the desire of the other can introduce feelings of shame, ending in the desire to not exist. Shame is a deep disappointment with oneself for not being desired, a feeling that the whole self is invalid. Yet it can only be...
It's probably the most realistic thing we can do is to recognize how we're just humiliating our neurons. You know, they could be doing something constructive and valuable, and instead they're obsessed with crap and bullshit. They're watching anime. Yeah.
Be felt before something of an audience, even if it's an imagined one. In shame, we view ourselves from an exterior perspective that...
So again, this is also kind of the whole argument about perfectionism and the idea of striving and competing again. So you're just back to this mechanism that's inside of us that just our desired self-image is a very clean and perfect thing. You know, like in The Matrix, you know, where you just imagine yourself as being really cool. And, you know, but our reality can never meet that standard. And so there's always going to be disappointment because we're really flawed in so many ways. And even your genetics is against you. You know, you lose your hair, all this stuff happens to you, ruins your self-image, and just makes existing that much more unpleasant.
Of the big other. The desire of the big other isn't as simple a matter as merely doing what other people...
I mean, it's just, these are just absolute facts. There's an absolute truth about ugly and pretty and symmetrical and non-symmetrical. Your face got burned off in a fire and it's hard to look at it. These are all just facts. What's the point of pretending that we don't have to all accept? You know, and look how it gets so intense. The closer you get to being complete or you know, not perfect but close, the more intense you get about any imperfection. And so you see that in so many, like the models and all the other people go crazy because all they have to do is lose a little tiny bit and that's seen as an ocean of imperfection. So yeah, we're vulnerable to all kinds of this psychology that destroys our self-image.
What people want from us, it's about wanting the thing other people want. Shinji is afraid that he has no desirable qualities other than being the pilot of his...
So who knew? Who knew that this video called The Desire Not to Exist is about some anime story? Shinji. I can't, how do you even spell this stupid thing? I gotta go find this stupid anime? This has all of these brilliant life lessons in it? I don't think so.
Ava. And to be fair, he's not so far off. He's let the demands of other people dominate him. Demands that stem from their own unresolved issues. Misato wants
Luke, I'm, Darth Vader's your father.
Shinji to be what she could never be. Asuka wants him to be less apologetic in pursuing her, and by the end of it all, it's still not really clear what his father desires of him. Notorious is the dynamic that plays out as a result.
Ah, it really is a Star Wars. It's just like, is this one of them walking machines? Can't remember what they were called.
Shinji thrashes about in indecision, hesitant to pilot his Eva knowing the pain it will cause him, but nonetheless wanting to please others.
Oh, brother, this is... I don't know. I just don't know how the... How this... Anyway. Just funny how brains interpret.
He's told to only do it if he wants to, which is really just a more severe way of being told to do it and enjoy it. The presentation of a choice here is really an illusion. All of this culminates into the conflict of Shinji's own desires as they bite and cower at the desire of the Big Other. In certain scenes and through certain responses, we see that Shinji is ashamed that his desires are not those of the others. One can think life is full of good and still not want to fully take part in it.
Life is full of good and you don't want to take part in it? I don't want a new car. Yeah.
Rebelling against all existence, he thinks he has acquired evidence against existence, against its goodness. The despairer thinks that he himself is this evidence.
So whatever that is, rebelling against all existence, he thinks he has acquired evidence against existence. So it doesn't say anything about, it just says rebelling. It doesn't say observing a world full of waste and torment. He thinks that's a good argument against, okay, against its goodness, whatever its goodness is. You know, what? sorry. Goodness?
Acting against what we desire or feeling disgust at what we desire both lead to shame. Both involve a sensitivity to the Big Other. Desire always plays some sort of a role in shame because the true nature of our wants constitutes a fundamental part of the self. Despair over something, such as rejection, really is despair over having a self, writes Kierkegaard. I believe the desire to not exist can be understood as an expression of frustration at one's individual existence.
Whatever this is. So now he's doing some other story in the middle of this story.
Despair rages in each of us as we acknowledge the truth that we are not one. But rejection especially bruises those who desperately want to be desired.
So there's not one thing. Again, what is the communing with what? You want to commune with Ted Bundy's brain? You know, some psycho killer tortured people and got off on it? Yeah, I don't want to. No, I don't want to have. I don't want to be oneness. Okay, with sadistic lunatics. People who think they're God. Why would I want to spend time with people who think they're God?
These persons who suffer from the desire to not exist really want to have no desires, to experience the freedom and peace of a complete dissolution of the self as it is known.
Okay, nobody does this. Okay, so this is just, who? Show me one person on this planet right now that's why they want to not have a desire is because it's not because desires are unpleasant. It's the fact that they're going to be left unsatisfied is unpleasant. They just don't want to have to, whatever that would even feel like.
We will never be one, but after I cease all striving forward, perhaps I can numb the pain inflicted on me by my neglected desires. Everything that matters to me matters in this world. And that's the precise reason I find it all so tiring. The cold anesthesia of nothingness is the nuclear option for desire. This attitude of distance is fully displayed in the behaviors tied to the desire to not exist.
This babble, 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 babble. Nuclear desire, what?
There's just one more thing I wanted to understand. What's the solution? In order to figure that out, I first thought it necessary to get as close as possible to actually experiencing nothingness myself. Sensory deprivation tanks are pods of salt water that work to eliminate each of the five senses.
So they're clearly not nothingness because your brain is still in the, you know, still playing the big sense, the sense that has more power than any of the other senses. Your imagination is still functioning.
In them, there's no light, sound, or gravity. In order to experience what nothingness is like, I decided to jump into one of these things.
So again, I don't think this has anything to do with reality either. So this is like a Michael Jackson thing or something.
After setting up an appointment at a place that offered these, I step in and begin to float. The lights turn off, and slowly my world is ending. Finally, only I remain.
So my world is ending, he means everybody else goes away, leaves him alone. So this whole thing that was supposed to be about the desire not to exist is the desire to get everybody else out of the building. Oh, okay.
There is nothing, only warm primordial blackness.
My body is sleek from the salt. The water feels as if it expands out infinitely. My limbs grow heavy. In the darkness, my eyes project forth the afterimages of meaningless shapes and colors that I spend some time assembling into coherent objects.
I mean, this really isn't. You don't need a whole tank and all that kind of crap. You put some earplugs in, lie on a nice bed, and just force your limbs to relax, and you're close enough.
My time in that pod felt both instantaneous and infinite, almost like a dream. When it did end, stepping out of the darkness, I felt as if I was emerging from an imaginary space deep within myself. And yet, I found that the peace I experienced there did not make me hate existence. I rather felt content with it.
Oh, just too ridiculous. So now it's an anecdotal story about his, grand adventure, floating in some salt water.
In episode 20 of Evangelion, Shinji is dissolved into a primordial soup inside of his mecha with only his consciousness remaining.
Kinda like me here. Kinda.
Given the choice to remain in this state of nothingness or to return to the physical world, he contemplates his self-worth. We're again introduced here to the fact that Shinji determines the value of his existence.
Yes, and he decides to go back to his pot-washing job. I don't think so.
Through how desirable he is to others. We are to understand, however, the solution that is proposed here, as it is this that ultimately influences Shinji's desire to return to the real world.
It's your future. Only you can decide, Shinji. You must make a choice.
All philosophy is in some way an interpretation of the philosopher's own experiences.
No, it's really this dissecting thing. You have to do a bunch of science, and figure out how things actually work, not the way they look, And, volcanoes or something, you have to kind of, it's the plate thing, and that's moving across another plate, and that's what's making all this heat. So that's why the volcanoes are in some places and they're not in the other places. It isn't because the Earth is just full of lava and it just pops up to the surface. No, that ain't really the story. So if you want to get it right, you have to do all this work to figure out what the hell we are. But you can take some story like evolution, some theory, all right, and it can make perfectly good sense, and you can realize, we're just bugs that can sing and dance, and we can have this delusion of accomplishment and purpose, but we're just bugs. We're just like the other animals. A crocodile's a crocodile's a crocodile's a crocodile, okay? I mean, yes, they all have individual sizes and they're all individual, some are crankier than others. But so what?
Sensory deprivation, although not as surreal an experience as to what Shinji goes through here, helped me to understand that there is yet another way to imagine ourselves returning life the ticket. We do not need to allow the immediacy of our existence to define us.
So somehow it's returning, you're ending, you're escaping your life by jumping in a tank and thinking about your life. Oh.
We can learn to create out of the void that we yearn to return to. We all have the ability to go from feeling a mixture of pleasure and guilt in our desire to feeling secure in the thing that propels our desire. I believe that part of this process is learning to...
Oh, he believes it. Oh, wonderful. So whatever, cowboy man believes it.
To decide for ourselves how we feel about our desires and what causes them, instead of presenting ourselves to be judged by a jury of our own conjuring. we must understand that everything in this life is in a constant state of becoming. All people will continue to grow closer.
Well, none of this really has to do with your life in the sense that most of your personality, subjective, reactionary reflexes were constructed in your youth, and you're going to just be stuck with them for your whole life. You're going to be a reactionary beast, and you know, you won't be able to just think your behavior. It's just not going to happen that way.
And farther from each other in an endless variety of ways. In our simulated eternities, we fear that we will always...
In our simulated eternities, blah, 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 whatever those are. I've simulated eternities? I don't think I do.
...to be prone to repeat the same mistakes, to desire the same things, and to always be the disgust...
Yes, that's always what it's going to be. It's going to be the same chase, the same learn, the same lessons, the same, oh, failure, blah, 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 over and over and over.
...trusting person we are now. If we trust in the idea that even the absurd is possible, we can instead push...
Well, even the absurd is possible. So again, yeah, so the impossible is possible. If you can believe that, then you're going to be a good anime player. Whatever.
...forward to carve out opportunities for our acceptance. Shame arises when we trust in the big other to decide what is acceptable for us. But the actual people in our lives, while they might not always agree with what we desire, still have the chance to accept us if we trust them. Friction will...
And that will solve what problem? No.
Always exist between what they want and what we want. Accept that, and you can take the risk to be accepted yourself. In taking that risk, and accepting the potential pains of desire, you'll already have made steps towards accepting yourself and moved beyond the desire to not exist.
Oh, yeah, what a pile of mush.
If you enjoyed this video, you'll absolutely love my video on the game with a perfect portrayal of trauma.
The game. So, video games too. Great. Anyway, it's hard to imagine. 6 million views for that tripe. Shit. Yeah, just hard to live in a world this crazy. But I'll do it anyway, since I'm here. Alright, so I probably should have watched that ahead of time. And says, you know, that's one of those videos where, my bad, I thought it would be something about something, and it was nothing about nothing. So yes, waste of time, beyond just the fact that this is pop culture of some kind, or this is, you know, somehow this stuff can appeal to human beings, this, whatever it is, mushy mush talk about some kind of vague notion of boogeyman, and you can destroy your boogeyman and then win your life back or something, and then something, 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 and live happily ever after. So I guess a lot of that anime stuff is just going to be that kind of crap, right? Where this is all about some 13-year-old angst. And then the end, he's 16, okay? And now he's got a whole life to fuck up, you know? You know, in terms of get stuck in some kind of, you know, relationship that's just like a ball and chain. A job that's a ball and chain. Kids that are a ball and chain. And so all this talk about liberating and freedom and, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm going to get to the top of the mountain and, you know, tie a bunch of rocks to your feet and it's all over. It's all downhill and it's going to be a bumpy ride. Anyways, you know, this is just all such bullshit. Like, all of these stories are going to end in some sort of, again, it's just, we're just, still doing this happily ever after. Let's tell a story and make it go no further than, and then it was November 17th and everything was fine. Yeah, 6 months from now they got cancer and the, you know, all this, you know, they just take out all the reality part and just leave you with some sense that, okay, they, you know, crossed the great river, okay, and now they're on the other side of the great river. Yeah, so what? there's no promised land. So yeah, you could just make it into that kind of thing. You know, the whole, you know, the the slaves, you know, getting liberated, and then a few decades later they turn around and start running back home because their liberation wasn't what it was supposed to be. So anyway, just such a pile of crap. And such, and so forth and whatnot. So anyway, kind of a waste video, turns out. But, you know, there's value in just about, you know, you can find some kind of value in just about anything. So I'll try to find some sort of value in this, this crap that banged on my neurons. And I'll see if there's something in there to make a lesson out of. But, it was real tripey. All right, till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. My apologies.